Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Spirituality of Grief. 10 Practices for Those Who Remain by Fran Tilton Shelton. Narrated by Susan Hanfield. Chapter 1. How do we begin? Telling your grief story. Nothing can make up for the absence of someone we love, and it would be wrong to try to find a kind of substitute. We must simply hold out and see it through. This sounds very hard at first, but at the same time, it is a great consolation, for the gap, as long as it remains unfilled, preserves the bonds between us. It is nonsense to say that God fills the gap. God doesn't fill it. But on the contrary, God keeps it empty, and so helps us keep alive our communion with each other, even at the cost of pain. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Grace and peace. These are the first words I say at the beginning of the bereavement workshops I lead. I speak the words slowly, as I make eye contact with each participant. I gently repeat them. Grace and peace. Grace and peace. I pray that the words will permeate the deafening silence of fears, the syncopated sadness, and the questions that crowd the large room. I pray that grace and peace will come to me too. Through my work with Faith in Grief, a nonprofit I co-founded that provides resources for comfort to those who have experienced the death of a loved one, I have led many sessions like this. Yet no matter how many grief workshops I facilitated, I always get anxious before the first meeting. I wonder who in the participants' families or networks have died, and how their deaths occurred. I worry about how the group will gel, and I wonder if the participants are ready to accept invitations to share with the group. Each participant has already demonstrated courage, twice. First, in registering for the workshop. Second, in showing up for the beginning class. For people in the throes of raw, profound grief, these two acts can require tremendous effort. You are demonstrating courage too, by starting this book. When a loved one dies, what used to be simple decisions, return a phone call or not, make the bed or not, listen to this book or not, become difficult or almost impossible. And choosing to listen to a book that takes you deeper into the subject of grief rather than escape it takes courage. In workshops, I promise that participants will be invited, not required, to share personal information over the course of our time together. The only requirements are that they attend all sessions, hold conversations in confidence, refrain from comparing their grief to that of others, and feel free to interrupt me at any point for clarification or to share an aha moment. As you listen to this book, you too can engage to the extent that you desire. The ideas and practices I provide aren't requirements, they're invitations. Then I invite workshop participants to silently read this quotation attributed to Isak Dinesen. All sorrows can be borne if we put them in a story or tell a story about them. A man of about 70, attempting to hold steady a venti Starbucks on his knee, which is bouncing to the rhythm of an accelerated heartbeat, breaks the silence. "Isn't she the one who wrote Out of Africa?" Yes, she is, I say. She also wrote Babette's Feast. His question is none other than grace verbalized, as it makes others feel more comfortable speaking. I ask, how many of you have seen one or both of these movies? Some heads nod affirmatively, while others murmur that they had heard of them. A young woman shares that she saw Babette's Feast in a college class. I tell the group that Isak Dinesen, the pen name for writer Karen Blixen, was 9 years old when her father, riddled with syphilis and depressed after fathering 2 children out of wedlock, hanged himself. His death by suicide changed her life. The love Blixen held for her father never left, and she continued to yearn for his company and affection the rest of her life. But she also learned that in order to carry the weight of this sorrow and future sorrows, she needed to put her experiences, feelings, and questions in the form of a story. Just as Dinesen shared her story, we are going to begin to do the same, I tell the group. Let's start by saying our first name, the name and relationship of our loved one who died, and when he, she, or they died. I'll begin. My name is Fran. Bob, my husband, died on March 4, 2018. A few in the group begin to share, and some are unable to finish as emotion overcomes them. It is a difficult step to give voice to such love, to such pain, to such reality. For some, the most difficult part is saying the name of their loved one. Such a simple expression becomes a complicated task. One woman admits that it feels good to say Brendan, her son's name, because it assures her that he is not forgotten. It bothers her that her friends won't say his name because they are afraid it will upset her. They don't understand, she says, wiping away tears. How can I be more upset? I'm always thinking of him. Names are important. They give us our identity. Nicknames or pet names are equally meaningful, as they anchor us in our relationships and even in the timelines of our lives. When a person asks me about my husband by calling him Gunner, Brownie, Robert, Dean Shelton, President Shelton, or Bob Bob, I can put Bob in a certain place, time, or role. Think about all the names friends and relatives called your loved one. How do those names reflect different parts his, her, or their life and story? And how might saying your loved one's name help you, over time, learn to carry your sorrow? I wrote this book to guide you in learning to tell your story of love and grief. I hope that it can be a companion during a time that can be so shattering and terrifying and lonely and gut-wrenching that you wonder if you can even take another breath. Sharing our grief stories is a way of riding the waves of grief that wash over us after a loved one dies. Those waves can be so immense and powerful that in the middle of them, we may feel like we're going to be forever caught in the undertow. Yet with practice, we can begin to discern the pattern inherent in the waves, the approach, the rise, the crest, the break, and finally, the way it settles. We can begin to trust that eventually, the wave of grief will set us down on the shore. This book is not designed to help you move on or let go or find closure. Rather, it will help to sustain you and your connection with your loved one. It will expand your heart to trust that steady, solid ground is still there, beneath the tidal waves of grief. It will help you find your footing, and it will help you carry the weight of your grief. How can we carry our sorrow? To some people, especially those experiencing raw grief, the concept of learning to carry our sorrow is a new and even unbearable one. When Isak Dinesen says, "All sorrows can be borne," we may wonder if she is telling the truth. The word "borne" comes from a Hebrew word meaning to lift up or to carry. If your loved one has just died, the idea of carrying your sorrow sounds impossible. Just carrying the trash out to the curb may take all your strength these days. How can you begin to carry the weight of this immense, immovable grief? When we bear our sorrows, though, we not only carry the sadness of our loved one's death, but also all the stories of their life. By telling our grief stories, we discover an inner strength that equips us to lift or carry our sorrows, rather than to be pulled down by them. Many people experience a visceral desire to get over, walk around, or ignore their sorrow, rather than carry it. Ron's wife died 5 months before he attended one of our workshops on faith and grief. He was disappointed that his daughter, their only child, wouldn't talk to him about her grief. But at the registration table for the workshop, he articulated something akin to his daughter's unwillingness to talk. "I just want to get over this and move on," he said. "I just want to get over this and move on." Many people facing grief feel like Ron and his daughter. Even though he wanted to talk about their shared grief and she didn't, they both just wanted to get over this and move on. Such desires spring from our self-preservation and survival instincts. We don't want to hurt more than we already do. Truth be told, however, it's impossible to hurt more than we already do. Spirituality and faith offer important ways to carry our sorrow. When we open our hearts to the wisdom given to us from spiritual and religious traditions throughout history, we learn that bearing our sorrows will take us on paths we may not have traveled before. As we walk these paths, we slowly encounter insights into the mystery of love that is stronger than death, patience, compassion, solidarity, humility, and gratitude. In the work of faith and grief, we see faith as a source of comfort and strength in times of bereavement. All faith traditions value grief and mourning and offer practices to sustain and give solace. We find that grief is both a leveler and a uniter, bringing together persons from diverse faith traditions and backgrounds. While I write as a Christian, you will notice different faith traditions reflected in this book. Grief workshops bring together people from different faiths to share their stories and experience community. Time and again, we hear how spiritual practices give comfort and hope to those who remain. Psalm 23 in the Hebrew scripture assures us, "Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." The psalmist does not avoid walking through the darkest valley because of an abiding trust that God will walk alongside him. Walking through the valley is both a description of grief and a prescription for working through it, step by step. Even as adults, we may feel intimidated or still have childlike fears of the darkness. We can't see where to step. We are anxious that some unseen object will trip us along the way, or that we will get stuck in a miry bog. Keep in mind that there is no prescribed time frame for grief. There is no shortcut, no spiritual bypass. The canyon or valley that forms inside us when our loved one dies will never go away. The sorrow that has taken up residence within us since the death of our loved one will never dissipate. Rather, through God's grace and mercy, we learn to forever carry our love for them and their love for us. In this book, we will discover meaningful and spiritual ways to keep alive our communion, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote. Each chapter will focus on a central question that grief brings to us and a spiritual practice that can help us carry our sorrow. You can try these spiritual practices no matter what your faith or religious tradition might be. I offer these practices not to help you get over your grief or to move on or even to heal. They are not intended to replace your grief with some substitute. As Bonhoeffer said, nothing can make up for the absence of someone we love. Instead, you could think of them as containers for your sorrow, something to put your sorrow in to help you carry it. Why do we tell our grief stories? Psychologists, brain scientists, and researchers have learned that a bond of hope is created between us when we engage in telling and listening to stories. Listening to and reading stories encourages the release of the hormones oxytocin and cortisol. Oxytocin controls responses such as empathy and social interaction. Cortisol is connected to reducing stress. The release of these hormones better equips us to face the future, full of unknown circumstances, without the physical and emotional support of our deceased loved ones. Years ago, I overheard a workshop participant say, "Telling my story and having my feelings validated takes away much of the fear of grief." Similarly, a woman whose mother died from a glioblastoma said, "I feel stronger just by listening to what others have gone through. They help me believe I can cope too." Alan Hugh Cole, Jr., theologian, professor, and author of Good Morning, Getting Through Your Grief, stresses the importance of telling, retelling, or rehearsing one's story. He provides an image of the healing power of story. The word hearse, he tells us, a vehicle used to carry the dead body of a person in a coffin or casket to a funeral and cemetery, comes from the Latin word herpex, which means harrow. A harrow is a trusty, rake-like, toothed tool. Gardeners value the harrow because it helps them till and break up the soil for planting new growth in their flower and vegetable beds. Cole likens the telling of our personal sorrow to the work of a harrow. Each time we tell or rehearse our story, we are figuratively tilling the very soil of our soul, breaking up the crusty clay of emotions lodged in our heart so that new growth can take place. Without being fully aware that we are doing so, we tend to rehearse certain parts of our stories. We tell and retell the parts that we are working to reconcile with the parts of our larger story. It is important to find people, such as a friend, counselor, bereavement group leader, spiritual director, or rabbi, priest, pastor, or imam, who understand the importance of rehearsing your story. Back in the workshop on grief, as I described the importance of telling our stories, one woman quickly speaks up. "I don't want a new life," she tells the group. "I want my old life back with my husband. And I'm going to scream if one more person tells me that I must get used to a new normal." She makes air quotes with her fingers. "In fact, I might even punch them in the face." Everyone laughs, and some raise their fists in solidarity. Sometimes people are surprised by the amount of laughter that takes place in a circle of storytelling. Experiencing these moments makes me more appreciative of the work of oxytocin and cortisol. Laughter can set us free to release immeasurable sadness and restock our bodies with endorphins. The desire to have our life back the way it was is real. The desire of our friends to help us achieve a new normal is real as well. Even though these desires cannot be fulfilled, we long for them. And with each telling of our story, measures of healing do take place. In rehearsing our story, the rocky soil of resentment can be turned over for seeds of new growth. The alluvial soil flooded with tears of sadness can receive necessary air and light. The caliche, or hard sedimentary layer, can be broken and tenderized to keep it from becoming calcified. Yet rehearsing our stories isn't some magic pill. Each telling takes courage and trust. Each telling may vary in the details, according to which portions of the story we need to process. The more opportunities to tell and rehearse our story, the greater the amount of healing. The more we can tell our stories, the greater our ease in carrying our love. Because healing requires multiple tellings of our story, friends, family members, and colleagues sometimes grow weary of our repetitions. They may even say something bold or insensitive like, "You've told me that before," or, "Again?" or, "When are you going to get over this?" Your friends mean well. They just don't get it. Keep telling your story. Again, if need be, find a professional to help you process your grief. You and your grief story are worth it. When my husband was diagnosed with vascular dementia and Alzheimer's, he requested that I not tell anyone, including his adult children. I quickly made an appointment with Mary, a professional counselor. Mary is legally blind, which I believe heightens her ability to hear the stories her clients tell. She could not see my tsunami of tears, but she heard them with compassion, week after week after week. Mary listened to me tell of my anger toward Bob's neurologist when she informed us of his diagnosis and suggested that he exercise more. Bob walked 3 miles a day, and in inclement weather, on the treadmill for an hour. More? She listened when I told her about the fear that froze my blood when Bob got lost one day. She listened when I told her how much it meant to me when a nice salesman taught me how to tie a man's tie so I could dress Bob for his sister's funeral. She listened when I shared how, the day after Bob's own memorial service, I broke a tooth that led to months of dental work and literally could not smile for 9 months after Bob's death. Mary listened as my tears surfaced and resurfaced, as I rehearsed my grief and love. You are not alone on this journey. The spiritual practices in this book and the connections with others who have lost loved ones can help you ride the waves of grief. Learning to breathe. After a loved one dies, Many people say they feel like their breath has been knocked out of them. After my grandmother's son, my uncle, died unexpectedly, she said, "Since Rudy's death, I have not been able to take a deep breath." Traditional Chinese medicine has a holistic view of the mind and the body. This tradition recognizes that grief and sadness directly affect the lungs. When individuals are unable to express emotions or are being overwhelmed by them, their lungs weaken, compromising respiration. Typically, this manifests as difficulty taking full breaths or the feeling that something is sitting on your chest. Some people have a flare-up of asthma, allergies, or bronchitis during times of sorrow. Perhaps some of these symptoms ring true for you. Just breathing through grief is harder than people think. When the breath is unsteady, all is unsteady. When the breath is still, all is still. This is wisdom commonly attributed to a sage named Goraksha, who lived in India in the 9th or 10th century. Control the breath carefully. Inhalation gives strength and a controlled body. Retention gives steadiness of mind and longevity. Exhalation purifies body and spirit. In seminary, I was equally fascinated by the rough-and-tumble Hebrew language and the preciseness of Greek. My fascination grew as I learned that both the Hebrew word ruach and the Greek word pneuma, as in pneumatic, can be translated as spirit or breath. A spiritual practice of breath prayer can help you harrow the soil, aerating the ground of your griefs. In times when you're not sure you can cope, breathe. A breath prayer can help you transition from a state of anxiety to a place of peace. Breath prayer has been around at least since the 19th century, most notably in The Way of a Pilgrim, first printed in 1891. This is a story about an unnamed Russian peasant who was curious about the Apostle Paul's imperative to the early church to pray without ceasing. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 17. The wanderer traveled from place to place, seeking advice from scholars, priests, and sages about how to pray without ceasing. At last, a wise man unlocked the mystery for the pilgrim. "Breathe," the wise man said. Breathing is the one thing we do without thought and, most of the time, without pain. The pilgrim began to think, pay attention, and notice the rhythm of his breathing. He began a pattern of prayer famously known as the Jesus Prayer. With each inhale, he silently prayed, "Jesus Christ, Son of God," and he exhaled, praying, "Have mercy on me, a sinner." He continued his travels while breathing this prayer. Many faith traditions contain short prayers that can be used as breath prayers. As you learn and practice breath prayer, you might find that it helps you carry the weight of your grief. Spiritual practice. Breath prayer. Breath prayer begins by visualizing and feeling God's heartwarming love and breath enter your body and expand your lungs. Through breath, God graciously gives you the essential thing you need to exist. Begin by noticing your breath. There is no need to change its pattern. Simply notice. Allow each exhale to
Sample complete. Ready to continue?